Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay, and I'm happy to welcome to the show Preston Mitchell, movie lover extraordinaire. He's made guest appearances on Schlock and Awe, the Cobwebs podcast, Film Feast, the Cult Movies podcast, VHUS podcast, and several others. Preston, thanks so much for coming on Filmstrip.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay. It's a great pleasure meeting you. We were talking a little bit off mic about this franchise we're about to dig into and kind of how we came to it a little bit. And it's... we've talked about like me coming on your show for a little while now. And it's really cool that we're finally getting this opportunity. So once again, thank you for having me and thank you for being patient with me.
Oh, look, hey, the pleasure is all mine. And thanks for working around our crazy schedule here because it's been a long time coming. We're here to talk about From Russia with Love, starring Sean Connery, Pedro Armendariz, Lati Lenya, Bernard Lee, Daniela Bianchi, the voice of Barbara Jefford, and Robert Shaw. Directed by Terrence Young, released in 1963 on a $2 million budget, $79 million at the box office. From 1963 money to now, if you just scale that up a little bit, that's about $12 to $15 million budget and about a $200 million return. So this was a smash. And I mean, famously, this is the book that JFK put on like one of his, you know, I've read this in the last year and loved it list before he died. And rumor has it, this is the last movie he saw before he died. I don't know if that's true or not. That seems like a little bit of a historical happenstance, but either way, this was a huge thing at the time. And oddly enough, in Filmstrip, it's only the second Bond movie we've ever reviewed. Lindsay and I did Casino Royale back in the archives. You can go dig that one up. But Bond's not one that we've done a lot of. And it's not because anybody doesn't like it. We just never think about a good way to approach them. And I think in the early days of Filmstrip, we were like, we must do every chapter of everything. And that just kept getting to be a bigger list. And it was too much. Now we just got to do whatever. But that's why you're here, though, Preston, because in my circle bubble of movie Twitter, you are like the Bond aficionado. So you picked this one out. Tell us about your background with From Russia with Love and Bond and all that stuff.
Wow. I don't know if I can live up to that introduction, but I'll do my best. No, I in all seriousness, I love this franchise. It's arguably like it's the one that's made the biggest impact on me. There's a few that kind of rival that of movies that I individually like more than any Bond film. But as far as in its totality, I would say this franchise means a lot to me. And I think for two reasons. One, when I was a kid, and this is going to make you laugh, Jay, because again, I was a kid when this movie came out. But my very first one that I saw all the way through was Die Another Day. And
nice. I won't tell you how old I was when I saw that in theaters, but go ahead.
it kind of blew my mind just on TV. And I was like, okay, all these, I mean, it's a very campy version of the tropes that we all know and love that this movie kind of helped introduce, but seeing Brosnan in a suit, like in an ice palace, and there's all this crazy stuff going on, the guy with diamonds in his face. I was like, what is this franchise? And so it was actually my older brother and my mother. They are the ones who are like, oh yeah, it goes all the way back to Sean Connery. Sean Connery was my mom's biggest crush. And so from the get go, I started watching these Connery Bond movies. And what got me about those versus my initial one was how they kind of combine spy fiction and science fiction in a way that has been so elevated and has been foundational to how blockbuster cinema has gone for really the past 60 years, really. And how what I like about Bond is that it's always catching up with the trope, catching up with what's going on in the action movie world and kind of how it's adapting. It never does things first. And I think that's an important thing to put out there. It never does things first, but whenever it aims for something and whenever it hits, it's one of the best things that the genre has to offer for that specific era. And I definitely think this movie here, it's been one that I've always loved. And I mean, I saw Casino Royale in the theater. That was my first Bond in the theater. Because at that point, I saw Die Another Day so many times on home video and whatnot and on cable that going to see that in the theater, you know, with my couple of friends, and we were all just hooting and hollering until literally the last 30 minutes when we're actually almost crying, because that movie is so atypical for a Bond film. Yeah, I've always just been into these movies, even the ones that some people are like, ah, Preston, I don't know about that. I'm like, but guys, there are these cool little sharks here and there. So, you know, I'm such a nerd for this franchise.
Oh, look, man, I told a little bit of it on the Casino Royale podcast, but and I'll say it again for here. For me, Bond started with Roger Moore and a television event for Your Eyes Only. And my dad was like, well, if you're going to see that, you got to see the real one first. So he went and rented like Dr. No from Rush with Love and Goldfinger. And I watched all of those and then saw, you know, the Roger Moore. So there's a big gap, right? And then right along after that, like we would rent them here and there, like in pieces. But then TBS started running those marathons of them. And so I would just catch them, you know, and I would catch like all the Connery ones. I would catch a bunch of the Mormons. And through the years, I've seen them all, you know, multiple times. And I started going to Bond in theaters with The Living Daylights. This is the first one I saw in a movie theater. And then I didn't see License to Kill in a theater. And then I saw every one of the Brosnan ones in a theater and have seen every one of them since in a theater, except for No Time to Die. Oddly enough, I did not see that in a theater. I waited for home on that one. But yeah, I've seen him for years, but I always tell people like growing up, my Bond was Roger Moore. That was the of my era when I was a kid and stuff. But I kind of look at Bond as like each of them has their own little piece of doing something. And they're all sort of a reflection of their time. And that's what makes it cool. And that's what makes Bond so cool is that he drops into, you know, 60 years of American or really Western political pop culture and spy culture and all this stuff. And like you say, may not have ever been the first to do anything, but usually did it better and cooler than a lot of other people started borrowing from it. And that's what's neat. But when it comes to From Russia with Love, though, this was not one of the Connery ones I locked into at an early age because I was so fascinated with Dr. No. Like that to me just holds a special place. I feel like that one, like a lot of people will tell you the third Nightmare on Elm Street's the best one, Dream Warriors, right? And I'm like, I can hear that argument and respect it, but the first one's special to me for all of its sort of campy simpleness. And I feel the same way about Dr. No. Like it's incredibly simple. It's very basic, but there's just something about it that, and again, it's probably because it's the first one I saw, it just left an impression I've never forgotten. From Russia with Love, I think was harder to get as a kid because I don't think I understood everything that was going on in it. Goldfinger, Thunderball, much easier to swallow, you know, and sort of get. And then You Only Live Twice, even though that one's kind of complicated, pretty easy to follow. And I didn't see Diamonds Are Forever until years later and kind of sort of regretted it. Not entirely. Confession, I've never seen Never Say Never Again all the way through. I've never watched all the way through. I've even seen the spoof Casino Royale, but I've never seen the Never Say Never Again all the way through because I'm like, this is just, no, I just can't do this. This is something weird about this, but because I love Connery, but at that point I'm like, man, you're like, just put a beard on and grab a sword or something cool or be a dragon. which, you know, he obliged me with for many years. So I appreciate the man. Bless you, Sean Connery. But I love these, but you know, I came back to From Russia with Love years later and really began to understand like, oh, I see why I didn't latch into this when I was a kid or when I was younger. But I see why people like it and where they go with it. And a lot of it is Robert Shaw, but it's also the cast and everything around it. We'll get into it as we go through the movie tonight. But yeah, man, this one for me is one that I'm glad I saw when I did, and I'm glad I went back to it and picked it back up and now have a real high reverence for it. I think it's a pretty high mark in the Bond legacy and also in what Connery can do.
Oh, I'm with you wholeheartedly, 100%, Jay. I would say I loved this film. Like, okay, I would say I enjoyed this film when I was much younger, but it's definitely one that I've grown into. Because when I was a kid, the Connerys that like I really attached to were Goldfinger and Dr. No, and to an extent, Thunderball. Like those were kind of my Connery trilogy growing up. And I'm with you on Dr. No. Like a lot of people find it slow and dated in some respects, but to me, that's part of the charm. Especially just being such a classic movie fan. Like I like the fact that it's very small scale and simple. And Bond is much more of a brute that you later see in more recent iterations. Like, I think those things are preserved. And I think just, I mean, I can say this from my vantage point, just the whole mythology around Dr. No, like the whole fire dragon concept, and how it's actually a cheap looking robot that has fire breathing effects and kills his friend. Like I think there's a mysticism to it that really drew me in as a kid. And yeah, I mean, I but for Much to What Love, I feel like it takes a lot of what objectively really, really works about Dr. No. It sheds some of the more dated things and really creates something that is, I feel like, really bridges the foundational aspects of Goldfinger, because I feel like that's the gold that is considered to be the gold standard for many. And you and I were talking a little bit off mic. I feel like this is the gold standard for what, whenever people want a more serious Bond or a more grounded Bond, or at the very least a Bond where the plot matters and means something and has stakes, which as a franchise goes on is much harder to do. Whenever the series goes back to this in some way, shape, or form, it really is magical. And I think this movie is excellent at that.
Yeah, and it should be said that Ian Fleming's source novel from this and his whole background, I mean, those who may not know, he was a British intelligence officer in the Navy for a long time. And he used a lot of what he knew about real intelligence in those books. And this one is based off of like a real spy that was sort of sent over to try to defect and be a part of the British, but actually she was on their side. They, you know, the people that were sending her in as the secret agent didn't realize she had already been corrupted by the British anyway. So she was a double. But they based the whole Tatiana character in this on her. And Bond in a lot of ways is based off of a lot of the work Fleming did. So when it's ever the real stuff that you get to see him do, it's very similar to what they would do, like a decoder machine and all that spycraft stuff that it kind of gets played off more in like gadgetry and the more like formulaic Bond stuff, which is fun. And right. I love all that. But like you say, in the more grounded Bonds, I would say like this one For Your Eyes Only is a very grounded Bond, though it's very similar to You Only Live Twice and this movie.
Right.
Those are kind of grounded Bonds. You know, and I don't know that Brosnan ever got a grounded Bond. Bless his heart. I guess the world is on and off, but not so much because Christmas Jones. Denise Richards is still in that. But you know, like definitely Craig had like a very grounded, you know, Casino Royale is a very grounded movie in a lot of ways. Quantum Solace is too. And so when they get to that stuff, that's what it's always fun is to go back and see one of those. And you see that the first movie is an action adventure movie, right? And it's exotic and you got all these locations on this, and this one's got that too, but it's also very heavy in the subplot and the text that's there. And it's not all on James Bond to do everything. He's not a Superman. He's got all these people around him that help him all the time. He's got all these cool friends, you know, that he's not too prideful to let you take the shot. I'll do this. You know, he's got all this. And this one is one again that I think is one of the smarter Bond stories, and the people that run Bond, the Broccolis, and put to Harry Saltzman too, who is not a part of the modern franchise anymore, was definitely a part of it here. They understood that there's about six of these stories and we just need to repackage them, you know, in a lot of different ways. And they've done it successfully and they get new sheens on them. I mean, even Die Another Day is a sort of a You Only Live Twice kind of.
Well, the thing about a lot Die of Another goofies, Day,
you know, but they learn how to do that because they play to the audience at the time. Because at the time, that's what people wanted, was just that outlandish thing. And then, you know, you get stuff where people get, okay, let's kind of dial it back and get back to the roots. And that's where you get Casino Royale and all that stuff.
Right. And what I was going to say about Die Another Day, looking back at it in retrospect, I don't have the reverence for it that I did when I first saw it, even though it is my first Bond film. I will say, I think what they were attempting to do, and kind of what I was going to latch on to when you mentioned the similarities it has to You Only Live Twice, it kind of borrows from Diamonds Are Forever as well. And I mean, a lot of the movies recycle things from these earlier films, which I find fascinating. But with that film, it was the 40th anniversary movie because it came out in 2002. These movies began in 1962. And obviously that movie, you know, is reviled by many. Then 10 years after that, you get Skyfall, which is the 50th anniversary Bond movie. And it's interesting in that it's in this rebooted universe, but there's so many things that tribute each iteration of Bond, from having a double agent as the bad guy to having a lizard straight out of like the Live and Let Die world. you know, and it, even going as far back as the way they introduce reintroduce Q into the franchise, it going back to rewatch Professional Love today, I was like, oh man, this feels like the introduction of Q, because he's not introducing real gadgets really. Everything is tacked on and connects back to the suitcase. And the
fact it's very practical. Suitcase. Like you can see that mm-hmm. actually exists. And according to Fleming, that was a real piece of hardware that he knew about. You know, he said it's really like three pieces. He said they would never all be in the same place together, because it's kind of dumb to put all your stuff in one place. But you know, as a movie, as a gadget in a story, it made sense for him to have something like that. And then and again, the producers in the movie and Terrence Young, the director, realized like we need to kind of stick all that in one place. He's the one that sort of invented that idea that Bond right. is about the setup, the bad guy, the gadgets, and the baits, you know, and that kind of becomes the repeatable formula in different versions of the franchise. And Goldfinger really plays all of that. I mean, it's like the Back to the Future script of a James Bond script. It's going to hit right. every beat, set it all up, and knock it all down. And you know, I'm one of those that, again, this one I think falls more into the realistic side of what Bond could be if it was a real thing, and it's more fun that way because it plays on so many cool politics. But I think we should do a quick plot summary, get into this movie, and then we can start pulling it apart for people that maybe haven't seen it. I mean, obviously spoilers hot for a movie that's 60 years old at this point, but here we go. Agent 007 is now the number one target of an international criminal organization, Spectre, for his role in killing Dr. No in Jamaica. Spectre trains counter agents for this task, eventually setting on Donald Red Grant, an assassin who keeps a garrote in his watch. Additionally, Spectre wants to get its hands on a cryptography device known as the Lector from the Soviet Union's consulate in Istanbul, not Constantinople. Spectre deploys a ruthless former Soviet counterintelligence agent, Rosa Klebb, and she recruits the ravishing Tatiana Romanova to assist in seducing Bond unwittingly to help them. Bond connects with the head of MI6 in Istanbul, Ali Kerman Bey, incredible sidekick, we'll talk about him, who helps him make plans to steal the Lector. And aboard the Orient Express, they're tailed by Russian operatives. Bond and Kerman split up. Grant ultimately kills Kerman and the Russian operative tailing them, which casts doubts on Bond as to who's on whose side, which side is Tatiana on. Grant eventually drugs her and reveals to Bond when he kills both of them, he's going to make it look like a murder-suicide, which will throw the British intelligence community into an international scandal and thus elevate Spectre's big plans, which is to be the third fish waiting in the back for the two big fish to beat each other, the West and Russia at the time. However, Bond uses a booby trap briefcase to get the upper hand on Grant and ultimately kills him in a great fight aboard that train. Bond and Romanova use Grant's escape plans to flee Spectre agents in pursuit, dodging speedboats and helicopters. But Spectre isn't done yet, though. They dispatch Klebb one more time to take control of the Lector and take out Bond. And she and Bond get into a fight until Romanova gets a pistol and uses it to kill Klebb. Bond and Romanova then enjoy some romantic time in a canal boat as he throws microfilm Grant was using to blackmail them into the water as credits roll. That's about as tight as I can tell it. There's a lot that goes on in this movie. And for a movie like that, you would think nowadays, it's 2 hours and 50 minutes easily. Nope, it's a sleek 155. And I didn't even count the opening credit sequence. I mean, this movie comes in and out. And I think the thing about this one that I've always been amazed by, because I knew Dr. No didn't have the opening Bond sequence. And right. that only started because as they were putting this movie together in the editing bay, Terrence Young said, Sean Connery's not in this movie for 20 minutes. People are going to lose their minds if we don't put him on the screen. So let's take this scene where Grant kills him and put it in the very beginning of the movie, because it's kind of in a weird spot anyway. It doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't matter if they explain what he's doing later, because it'll set the tension right off the gate that, oh man, Bond's in real danger and we've got a real big guy to come after him. And I mean, it's so wild how something that is so iconic about James Bond was really an accident and something that happened in the editing room.
It's insane, isn't it? Like, and because when you watch the movie, it's so perfectly placed, I feel like, because I did notice today that after the opening, Bond's not in it for like the first 15 minutes or so after the credits. Like, you're literally following Blofeld and Kromstein and Tatiana Romanova is introduced at the consulate in Istanbul for the Soviet Union. Yeah, going back to the beginning, I think it's perfectly placed because from the get-go, different from the last movie. I think what you're getting is almost an anti James Bond in a way that's very analogous to something like Day of the Jackal, where another blonde evil James Bond kind of spy character, where the moment that Grant he hears an order from Rosa Klepp to get up, he literally gets up, and this woman is like rubbing his back and stuff like that. If it was James Bond, and we see that in Connery's next few scenes, where James Bond is like, oh yeah, let me procrastinate, let me hang out with Sylvia Trench from the last movie, let me go chill, and then I'll go to the mission, and then I'll go see him. From the get-go, this guy, he's able to kill a James Bond lookalike, so it sets up all this wonderful tension. And I just think that's just a beautifully shot, very shadowy nighttime sequence that we later find out is on Spectre Island, which is hilarious to me. But
they have their own island, right? Yeah, that's not conspicuous at all. It's before Google Earth exists, clearly, right? but what I love about it, though, too, is that they cast a great actor to play opposite, because you're right. Connery is a big guy. He's a brute, or he was, you know, and particularly in Hollywood standards. I mean, he towered over most everybody he starred next to. So you got to get somebody that's big enough that they don't look like freakishly big next to him, but they look big. And they got this big guy who, oddly enough, was like this genteel playwright. Like Robert Shaw, did acting as sort of a side gig, and he was a playwright. His son is now a playwright too, and does a hilarious send up of the making of Jaws. I think it's called The Shark Is Broken, and it was big in Britain last year, or the last couple of years. I think it's coming to America too. But
oh, wow.
and I've seen clips of it, and he's hilarious. He's a dead ringer for his dad. But Robert Shaw was a playwright and liked to do acting when he could, and so he got this because he could be big and brooding, you know. And I'm like, man, what a great catch to get this dude, because he's built like a bodybuilder. He's just a big guy. Mm-hmm. And all he was just a dude in the 60s, and those dudes could just pick up houses because that's what they did. Like, they were just big, strong guys. But I love that opening scene, and you can tell that, like, man, these people are seriously pissed at James Bond. Like, they're gonna send that much resources after one guy. It's impressive. It really is.
Oh, for sure. And I didn't know that about Robert Shaw, oddly enough. I knew you mentioned he was an actor as a side gig. Was he Shakespearean at all?
I don't know if he did that. I know he did some theater stuff. And I think most famously, like, he's known for stuff like Battle of the Bulge, and then obviously Jaws. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of the role that he had. It's funny to look at him and go, like, you know, 12 years later, he's playing a completely different person. But 12 years does a lot to you, kids. I'm just going to tell you. it's great to see like that, but you can tell he has some stage presence. And I think all these people, most of them had worked in stage at some point, because in a lot of ways, a movie was really just sort of taking the stage and making it three-dimensional. And you had to have people that knew how to play to an audience that wasn't there, but without making it look like they're looking directly at you. Right. And that takes a very special kind of actor to pull that off. And again, Shaw just had such presence. And apparently he and Connery really, they just thought they were great together in their scenes. And then every time they put him on the screen, he was cool. And he's not in the movie that much, but he's got such, like, his three or four big scenes. And we'll talk
about magnetism
later. Yeah, he totally, like, you're just drawn to him. And that's a hard thing to do when you've got somebody that is as magnetic as Sean Connery is in this movie, because he is such a presence on the screen. And I think what's neat about him as a performer is, and this is his whole career, he could be that guy, and then he could also just wilt into the shadow and let whoever else was in the scene just kind of do things. That's what Sean Connery was beautiful at. And one thing I wanted to ask you that I think is kind of neat about this, especially when we get into like the Spectre and their whole plans, and okay, number one died, so I need number two, or number two died, I need number one and number three to, you know, break up, figure this out. But people like to say, like, Quantum of Solace is like the first direct sequel, you know, and there's always been like little trail overs between movies and stuff. But I always argued that I'm like, no, this is pretty much a sequel to Dr. No, y'all. Like, the whole reason this is happening is for two reasons. One, they're really pissed that Dr. No got killed because it screwed up a big, like, plan they put a lot of money into. $1 million, Preston, they wasted on that satellite there. Gosh, can you imagine? And so they're like, okay, so how are we going to get back at these people? Well, the only way that the third party can throw the big two parties into chaos is to let them go at each other so hard that they weaken each other, and then you sneak in and get them at on the backside. And I'm like, man, Tom Clancy ripped that off for years, and like all his that's pretty much the story of all those, spoiler alert. And I like that, though. I love that conceit in this movie.
Agreed. Because I like to think of this movie in my head as kind of a loose trilogy. And I'll go back to your question in a second, but I just have to get this point out while I'm thinking about it, because it's written down in my notes towards the end. But I feel like Rosa Klebb in this movie, who is Blofeld's right-hand woman in this film, she's the general who defects from the Soviet Union secretly and becomes a part of Spectre, and is the one who draws Tatiana Romana into the Spectre side of the plot. Her and Ivan Drago in Rocky IV, and then I feel that Sean Connery's character in The Hunt for October, they all
Ramius,
they all form this loose trilogy of these Russian, they're basically Russian automatons, where they're used by bigger powers initially for their methods. And then Ramius, Connery, who is from this movie, he's the one who goes, wait, no, I shouldn't do that at all. And then he decides to defect in Red October. And of course, Alec Baldwin follows him while other Soviets and Americans are racing after him. And much like what you were alluding to with the plot of this movie, Red October kind of feels like the last movie in that trilogy to me, because it really does call back to a lot of the narrative mechanics of this film. And it's almost a McTiernan's commentary on it. Mm-hmm. And how do we bear our souls to each other when all we're doing is being at war with one another? And that's what I love about that film. This film, I think, keeping all that in mind, it's very Cold War, which Dr. No doesn't really dig into as much. I do think this is the film's first sequel. I completely agree with you, because much like any sequel, it really does, for one thing, it piggybacks off the events of off of the last movie. So when people say Quantum of Solace is the first sequel, I'm like, did y'all not watch From Russia with Love? Like, or are y'all just watching all the new movies? Which is fine, the new movies are great, but From Russia with Love is definitely, I mean, it's at least better than Quantum of Solace. I think we can all.
Yeah, I don't think you have to do a hard sell of that. It's not bad. Quantum of Solace is fine. It's just not.
Sure.
It doesn't, but to its credit, it never aspired to be what this was, and it was cut short by writer's strike. So they had to go with what they had. Sure. Like, they were trying to get that thing out. And so, there's an idea in there that's sort of half baked, and you just see it disappear, and it's like, yep, that's where the writer wasn't there to fix it anymore. So, but in this one, they had the whole thing, and I think you're right. And but we talked about in the intro, like, you got to look at every Bond in the era, and Connery and Moore are the Cold War Bonds, more the back end of the Cold War, but they're the Cold War Bonds. But we also got
Moore is more detente, I think.
Yeah, you're right. He is more in the detente era, and when it was clear the Soviets weren't going to last, and it was also clear Germany was now our ally, you know, but there was still a split, and we were more worried about still China and Korea and, you know, some of these other things, but Russia was starting to wane. And then, you know, you look at Timothy Dalton, and he was kind of the Cold War is over, but not really, but we don't know what we are anymore, Bond. Bless his heart, he didn't really get the best options. And then Brosnan is the post-Cold War Bond. And I mean, they call it out,
yes,
and they make a big deal about it. And they just have sort of stayed with that motif since. And then they do the
opening credits of GoldenEye are all the sickle, the hammer and the sickle falling apart. Like, that's
exactly,
and the whole Yanis motif, like Sean Bean is an embodiment of the Cossacks not refusing to let the Cold War dissipate completely, which is so apropos of what happens sadly today when it comes to big ideologies on the back end of dissipating. But
you're right. You're dead on. And I mean, that's what makes this thing cool, though, is when you look at it in context of what was going on at the time. Remember what was going on in 1962 and 1963. I mean, everybody was worried we were about to nuke each other at all times. When spy novels like this were a huge rage, because it's great escapism, but it feels so real. You can be a part of it. And the idea that there's this overarching villainous group of people who are kind of the rejects of their societies, like the only people are failures from the regimes they have escaped from in some way, but they sort of banty together to again be that, like, we're going to let the two big dogs fight. Like any good triple threat match has ever been booked before. There's always the one guy who gets thrown out of the ring and you forget about for 7 minutes. They come in to steal the pin when the other two are done beating the hell out of each other, and also known as the Daniel Bryan story. And I think that works, like, in a lot of ways. Like, really, it got, you know, it was Chris Benoit's too back in the day, and certain Jericho's done it. A lot of them have done it. It's usually the littler guy. That's who they give that to. Because, you know, how else are you going to have The Rock and Triple H lose to that dude, right? But anyway, I digress. But that's the idea. You got East and West just beating the hell out of each other, and then, like, you know, the Spectre leader, who's credited as Blofeld but never called that in the movie, but that's who we know this is. Mm-hmm. When he's watching those two fish fight each other and they have to tire each other out, and then the third one comes in, and I'm like, man, if only they could have, like, figured out how to make that third fish a piranha or something. Like, they probably would have if they could have. But, you know, these were, they had real fish. They didn't have money for that. But I think it's cool to watch all of that play out, because he lays out for you, here's the entire story. Right now, there's going to be three sides, and this whole movie is about triangles in different ways. And, you know, people get moved in and out of the different pieces, but there's always Bond, and then there's always Tatiana. And the thing about Tatiana is, you never know whose side is she really on until the very end. And if that other third piece keeps popping in and out, like, you don't know who Kerman's side's on until you really get to know him, and then he's out. And then you got Grant, but he also, like, saves Bond's ass a couple of times. You're like, well, aren't you supposed to kill him? What is this all about? And so it lays all these, you know, cool layers, and that's the only way you can keep a movie like this going for its runtime, is to have that going and have our protagonist not be ahead of the audience. And so many times in James Bond movies, he's so far ahead of everyone else that it's almost like, oh, you gotta watch everybody else catch up. And I like the ones, particularly the Connery ones, where he's not ahead of everybody. And in fact, like, almost all of Dr. No in this one, he's behind the whole time until the very end. So he's kind of fun to watch that way.
He's a pawn in a chess game, which is something that in pretty much Goldfinger is like the tipping point into the other direction that you were talking about, Jay, where he, even though he spends at least half the movie of that movie imprisoned by the title character, he has everyone's number up until he doesn't. And it's not until he actually denotes the plan in front of Goldfinger's face, then realizes that, oh, this is on a massive scale. You're not just robbing Fort Knox, you're playing on bombing it and having this radiate to something much bigger that's much more affecting and much more global potentially. And of course, that's the flip back to this. But, you know, in For Much Short Love specifically, it's I find the first 30 minutes of this movie to be so masterfully crafted story-wise, because it's literally 30 minutes in. I clocked it. The 30-minute mark is when Grant's already telling Bond on his way to go see Karen Bay, who's played by Pedro Almodóvar's senior, I believe. Of course, that's MI6's contact in Istanbul, who is, of course, in my mind, he is Tatia Romanova's equivalent, because she's an agent who works under General Klebb. So it has that whole thing going, and kind of the opposite inverse kind of thing as well that we were talking about with Red Grant. But already in 30 minutes in, we know Klebb, we know Kronstein, Blofeld, the fish thing you were talking about, Spectre Island is introduced, so that we know in future movies that this organization is big enough. It's not just Dr. No's lip service now. Like, this organization is big enough to where they're going to be threats potentially in future films. And obviously, this series being 25 movies in, we definitely know that that's the case. And again, like, there's such a contrast between Red Grant and James Bond, how Klebb, whenever she punches him in the stomach, suddenly, like, he's just stiff, you know? And whereas in the train fight later on, I know I'm kind of jumping ahead, and I don't mean to as much, but in the train fight, Bond is getting his ass handed to him a little bit. Like, he's getting hurt, he's bleeding out of the mouth a little bit. Like, this James Bond, this version of him, is infallible. So not only have we seen a version of him die up front, but over the course of this movie, he's not sure what the Bond girl is up to. And I don't think I gave this movie enough credit until today's watch. on just how well they draw the inquisitiveness of where Tatiana's motivations lie. Because I always think like, okay, Tatiana's in arguably my favorite older Bond film, but she's not that deep of a character. And I think that's to this movie's benefit because the plot is shockingly dense, but easy to follow. It's a very weird nexus this movie operates in.
It's really like you can boil it down to very simply this. It's Bond with evil James Bond chasing him. And who can Bond really trust? You know, and who does he learn to trust? And the way you earn Bond's trust is you prove it. You know, and I mean, when we go into M's office, right, he's doing the whole back and forth with them, and they bring in Desmond Llewellyn, who will eventually become Q, but he's Major Boothroyd again here. And he's
right.
Laying out this briefcase. It's got a knife in it. You turn it this way, it'll gas somebody. You can hide this rifle in the back of it. I mean, it's all this cool, like spy $6 million man shit.
And Connery's looking at him like, wait, this suitcase can do that? Like, I love his expressions in these earlier movies. He's like, wait, there's tear gas and it connects to there's a magnet in this suitcase. And there's gold bullion. It's so fun to
watch the evolution of the Q scenes in Bond movies too. And then like you talked about in Skyfall, when Q hands him a gun and a microchip, and he's like, a gun and a radio. And he's like, well, we don't do exploding pins anymore. That's not really what we're into. And he referencing GoldenEye. And I was like, that's awesome. I love that scene. It's probably my favorite scene in the movie that's not, you know, action based. And I was like, that is such a great callback because they have gone the full circle. Because the first one, I mean, the whole gadget scene is give me that crappy Beretta and take this Walther PPK, which hasn't shot both of those guns. I'm going to tell you, take the Walther all day. That thing punches like a brick. Like I've had that Beretta. It, you might as well throw it at somebody. The Walther, that's a serious weapon right there. It's in much, they don't look like much, but it's got it where it counts, as Han Solo would say. And
I've always been curious, like, is that why in Dr. No, like, when it comes down to getting a Beretta versus evading the tarantula in bed, he just reaches for the pillow at that point. He doesn't even get the Beretta. He just,
well, never mind, the tarantulas are poisonous, but okay.
Yeah. True.
But yeah, no, I mean, I love that too, but I love how, I mean, they make a whole scene out of that to call back to Dr. No. It's one of the best scenes when that guy, you know, fires off the Smith & Wesson 45 and he's empty and he's going to shoot him. And Bond just coldly says, you know, that's a Smith and you've had your six, and he just pops two in him and it throws him. And people are like, that's bull. So I'm like, have you ever shot a 380? A 380 will throw somebody back 5 feet away from you. Like that dude, like that's for real. Like that gun shoots like that for real. And again, having shot one, I'm like, oh, this thing is like for reals. Like it's got a lot of kick to it. And
I know people had to complain about that.
Like, it's everybody did any movie getting shot. I think because people have watched too much, and no, I know I have to watch too much Schwarzenegger Commando movies where people just explode off of, you know, risers. And I love that, by the way, just for the record. But yeah, I mean, that's half the fun of this kind of stuff. And but I like that in this again, that really the gadgets aren't about a gun this time. I mean, he gets a gun, but Bond doesn't really use the gun. Kermit's the one that ends up using it to snipe the guy that, you know, is crawling out of the woman's mouth or whatever. Bond, like, the only time he grabs a gun is he grabs a flare gun after he throws a bunch of gas in the river and lights the boats on fire, you know. And I'm like, I like when they let Bond not be tied to just a weapon, but it's tied to his brain and what he's got around him. And that I think that's so much fun, because I think the whole thing about the attaché case is that it's an environmental weapon. You have to know when to set it up and spring it on somebody at the right time, because otherwise it's just, you know, I mean, it's not going to work, you know, and you'll lose pieces of it. And the big piece of it, the gas blowing in somebody's face, you got to set somebody up for that. And that's what makes this so cool. So I love when they gadget him out and they give him all this and they tell him about this girl, and the way he dismisses her immediately, like, I know what I have to do. Fine, no problem. I'll mack this girl and then whatever. And he, you know, he plays her off to Moneypenny, which is always a cute scene to watch. And and I love how we meet her, though, and it reminded me of something that is more of a trope years later, but in a show like The Americans or that Jennifer Lawrence movie Red Sparrow, you know, there's like these beautiful women that get groomed to be these infiltration spies by usually these sort of haggard, scary women, right? Like that's kind of a trope.
Right,
and I'm
right.
like, it's born right here, y'all. And it wasn't made up. Fleming knew that was real. And I mean, that wasn't just, you know, that wasn't garbage, y'all. That was real. And think about it in terms of what we know in post-Cold War, how many of those people we use to infiltrate their society, how many they right. infiltrate us. I mean, it went both ways. And it's kind of wild to think about, like, oh, wow, you can see how that would work, right? But I love the introduction of Tatiana, the little bit we get with her and Kleb, because you get a real sense of, like, she is totally the puppet of Kleb the same way Grant kind of is.
Definitely. I mean, the thing about that scene as well is that there's a certain masculine energy to Kleb. I don't know if that's unsafe to say.
But no, I think you're dead on. I think being a woman general in that time, you might progressive, yeah. man. This movie is progressive as hell. There's a lot going on in this movie. We'll talk about it in a minute, but you're dead on. Go with that.
It's something I've noticed about this movie on the past several viewings is like, cause I think, it was about a few years ago. I rewatched this with my mom cause her and I, cause I got into Bond through her. Like she was the one who, and I mentioned my brother a little bit, but it was definitely her who was like, okay, Connery is my crush. Like, let me show you all these movies, that kind of thing. And she said something to me that's always rung true for me about, Kleb's character, in my mind, at least, where we see Walter Gotell on Spectre Island. He tries to take Kleb's hand. She backs off. And that can read both ways, where on one end, it's like, okay, she's either taking it as an attraction thing, which it probably was a flirtation thing on his part, just knowing how men of that time were. And she's reverting her hand back and to deject that. And then also, when we see her with Tatiana just a few scenes later and how she kind of strokes her hair and that kind of thing, it adds a bit of Javier Bardem and Skyfall-esque menace, where it's both the same sex who are, one is clearly in power and the other is tied to a chair, figuratively in this case. And Tatiana is made uncomfortable and she's already scared because she doesn't quite know where Kleb comes from, other than the fact that she used to be a general, which Tatiana believes that she still is. So there's all these different balls that are juggling, and we kind of, in a weird way, I guess I'm trying to imagine watch this movie for the first time, which is hard for me. But just taking what I know about the rest of the plot out of the equation, I think it's cool that they introduced Tatiana as such a blank slate. And then later on, after Connery literally wants to meet her after he and Karen Bay are using binoculars, and he's like, "Oh, she's nice legs."
And great Connery, the by the way. That's awesome.
Want to shoot the flash? Yeah, his madness comes into play, and then we see her in the bed, and it's like a very mysterious scene. We're just like, "Where is this going?" So, almost not knowing who exactly Tatiana is, once again, it works for his movie's benefit, and I do love that scene.
I think you've nailed two things there. And the way I've always read the Kleb stroking the hair thing or whatever, like, you can definitely read the sexual politics of those things, but I look at that more of like the way she gets control of these women, and women like Tatiana, is she's the mother they don't have anymore. And she can be firm, she can be strong, but she can also be incredibly loving, very Mother gentle. Russia. Yeah. Very much Mother Russia. And so she's easing her into it. I mean, she's a great manipulator, and I love that about her. And Tatiana's also a great manipulator, because her opening scene with Bond, she is standing behind a screen with nothing on but a smile and a bow around her neck, man, and jumps in that bed, and he rolls in there with a towel on and a gun going, excuse me. I mean, well, okay. And I mean, Neil Connery's like, okay, so the last time this happened in Jamaica, I had to shoot the lady and, you know, karate chop her because there was a snake in the tub and there are problems. So he knows, like, he's not dumb. And I love how he doesn't just go like, oh, boring, and runs right in there on her, you know. But he plays it. He plays into her hand a little bit, but also plays it very cool and very coy. And that, man, he has, you talk about,
well, like, he asked her, like,
a steamy scene. He's like, you know, I think your mouth's perfect. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, I can only imagine 1963 audiences clutching the pearls as they listen to that in a theater. Now, I mean, hell, that's tame, man. 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a sitcom, you get more than that. But I mean, TikTok's more, risque. But back then, ooh, scandal. And if you've ever read any of the Fleming books, man, they're loaded with that stuff. I mean, it's full. I mean, they're kind of pulpy beach reads in that way. And I mean, really, they are. Like, people that like read the Benchley novel Jaws, they get the story that's there, but they also get like this soap opera that you didn't expect to happen. It's really like sleazy. But it was at the time. Yeah, Hooper and Mrs. Brody. But yeah, I love that here, though, that Tatiana's got her own agency. She's still a blank slate, but she's got enough to, she can use those same kind of manipulative techniques, and Bond doesn't fall for it, but he kind of lets her think he does. And that's what's cool about it.
Well, Moneypenny kind of introduces that during the briefing scene, because this scene that I'm referring to, it's right after he's procrastinated with one of the Bond girls from the previous film who survived the last film. So a little bit of connective tissue there. Again, people, this is a sequel. The first sequel for Bond, just saying. But Moneypenny, this is right after he sees the picture of Tatiana, and Moneypenny tells him, okay, like, you're going to fall in some girl's lap, basically. That's basically what she says. And he's just like, oh, well, Moneypenny, it's all about you. Never, you know, that kind of thing. And I think the purpose of that scene, on top of being the generally cute Moneypenny Bond powwow that we get at the beginnings of most of these movies, I think that also sets up that he knows that this is a trap, because M deduced it just as much as he did. He knows, and Moneypenny knows, because we see her listening in on one of him and Tatiana's conversations later on. Everyone on the British side knows that this is a trap that's being set up. It's a question of how much does Tatiana know. And so I think Bond, going back to the pretty much the sex scene that we're talking about, that we were referring to earlier, I think part of the enticement is that Bond is kind of diving into it, knowing that, okay, this is danger, but I need her. I basically need her in order to get the Lecter device. Yeah. And she knows that, okay, I need Bond to be stalled in some way. This is my part of my ruse. This is part of what I'm doing, is I'm using myself. And so, which is partially why she's in the bed with him. And obviously I do think, because it's a Bond movie, she catches real feelings for him to an extent, but it's one of those things where I think there's a lot of psychological balls being juggled within that sex scene. I think that that's really cool. And he even asked her in the movie, she's like, so where can I find the plans for the consulate? She's like, let's wait until the morning.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing, is it's so hard to balance that in the Bond movie with the Bond girl that has enough wherewithal to kind of keep him at bay enough, but also pull him in. And I'll be honest with you, the one that did it best of all of them is Eva Green in Casino Royale, because one, she had the best story, and two, she's probably the best actress to ever take on one of those roles. No offense to anybody else that's played them, but she's incredible. And I had seen her in other stuff. So when they cast her in that, I'm like, that's a great fool aside of Craig, because she doesn't play around. That woman's fierce. But Tatiana has that same kind of thing going on. And like, a lot of it's very rooted in this story. It's what makes this movie so foundational to everything you think you love about James Bond movies. You probably forgot most of it started here. It didn't start in Goldfinger. It didn't start in, you know, Goldeneye, or, you know, Moonraker, if that's your favorite. I don't know anybody that says that, but, you know, there's somebody out there, I'm sure. But I mean, really, like, none of it started there. It's here. And she's not just a bimbo. You know, she's not just a dumb blonde. She's got her own thing going. And that's when they drop him into, like, a lot of times the middle segment of a Bond movie, like, they can come and go. They go high, they go low. They can kind of miss you a little bit. This is one of the best ones ever. When they get him in a situation with his counterpart, Karen Bay, who's got so much magnetism. That dude is
amazing. He has charisma out the wazoo.
Love him.
I forgot.
Is so good. I had forgotten it too, how good he is and how good they are together. like they have so much fun, and he's in there and the two gypsy girls are going to fight over a guy more or less. And at one point Bond goes, you don't have to translate. I can figure it out. You know, like, I've got it. Cause this guy's like, you're going to fight over my son. You know? And I'm like, I love this whole gypsy thing and all this stuff because Bond is completely in a different world than Karen Bay lives in, because he's got a friggin' periscope in his consulate going up into the Russian consulate or in his cave. And then Tatiana comes from all the tech world. And then you get into the gypsy encampment where it's primitive, man. We are living, we're in the settlement now. And we're just getting into the old times. And I love that whole sequence. And in any other movie, that could seem like a wasted 20 minutes, but it's so foundational to what goes on. And then when the raid comes in and they have that killer like Western gunfight going on, and Grant shows up and shoots that one guy in the back before he gets a chance to kill Bond because he's mine, he's not yours, or whatever, you know, just cast doubt and do all this stuff. It's an incredible scene. And somebody who grew up watching a lot of Westerns and stuff, I always forgot how much that shootout scene reminded me of like Fistful of Dollars and stuff like that. Like it's foundational to all those things.
Well, it's set in the middle of a gypsy fight, kind of celebration party type of event. So it kind of has that spaghetti Western quality to it. And literally this is a year before Fistful of Dollars came out, which I think is so ironic. Like it has, again, a little bit of that lineage to other action-y kinds of films. I think too, another cool thing about that sequence is that Grant's also, he's instilling doubt in Bond a little bit, even though Bond himself doesn't know that we know who Grant is, where he is, and that kind of thing. He does suspect that someone is picking. I think he's like, okay, why are these bodies falling around behind me? Like, aren't these people trying to shoot me? I think that's what's going on in Connery's head. And with Grant, though, I think with his character, he's picking Bond off because he needs him to get the Lecter device. Jay, because you're a Bond nerd as well, I keep wanting to say ATAC machine. I keep wanting to say Bond's gonna get the ATAC. No, that's the wrong movie. That's For Your Eyes Only.
But you see what I mean, right? We got a good idea. Let's just recycle that a little bit differently. Because For Your Eyes Only plays a lot like this movie does. It really does.
It does, which is why it's awesome in my opinion.
Exactly. Yes.
but no, Grant, oh man, I love that whole battle sequence. I love the fact that, because you talked about this a little bit earlier, Jay, where one of the tropes in Bond, and it's something that I share in my love with this character, is that I think Bond works best when the gadgets are kind of like at a moderate to low level, because that allows Bond to use what's around him, kind of like a martial arts movie, to incapacitate his foes. Because it seems the way it's filmed comes off very cool in this part where there's all this shooting going around. It's a quick blink or you miss it sequence where Bond is looking around. He's shooting people here. He's kind of knocking people out there. He's only really shooting people who present a real sense of danger with weapons. Whereas the two people firing up behind him, he takes a machete. He tears down a bit of tent right behind them, and then he just lets them fight underneath the tent so that they're blocked. They're both blocked from the bullets that are overhead, but they're also blocking his way to get to where he needs to be to try to save Karam in this case. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. It's environmental awareness. When you see somebody that can just sort of bounce between the place around them and use everything around them to dispatch what's in front of them. I mean, oddly enough, it's one of the things that the latter Mission Impossible movies that Tom Cruise has done, particularly the ones he's done with Christopher McQuarrie, that are really good at.
Yes.
You know, like you just use what's there, you know, and I'm with you, man. When they downplay the tech, what that allows them to do is let Bond be very environmentally aware, but also it allows for a sidekick, a partner, somebody else to get in the mix and be a part of things. And such a great presence like Karen Bay here. It's so neat.
Realistically, it would take multiple people to pull off, because the first half of this movie is pretty much a heist movie, which is cool.
Yeah, so you kind of need Lecter. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all they're doing. And so you kind of need a Rusty to Connery's Danny.
Yes.
And that's what Karen presents.
Yes, he is. Yeah, you need that sidekick, that partner, that Robin to the Batman, if you will, to make this work. And I love how, like, he even lets him take the shot to kill the guy that had led the raid, that's, you know, got the Lector, the keys to it. He's like, you know, and the guy's even got a, you know, busted arm from where he got shot. He's like, I need to pull the trigger. He's like, go right ahead. And he just lets him use his shoulder and just blows the guy away. And I love how, like, you know, it's where the Bond quips start too. Like, you know, he's crawling out of a, like, a cigarette ad with the girl with her mouth open. He's like, yeah, should keep her mouth closed. Yeah, you know. And I was like, well, they're gonna put that in, but okay. But I love it. I love all of that, because you're right. It's a heist movie, and I love heist movies. I'm just a sucker for all of those kind of things. Same. And so, yeah. So, I love the cat and mouse of it. And then when we get on the Orient Express, we're in a different movie. And then we're, yes, in a, like, we've gone to exotic locations, and now we're going to shrink this movie down to a train. That's a bold choice, because generally you ramp up, right, in a movie. When this one, we're going to shrink it down. And most Bond movies, they do go bigger, but this one, nope, we're going to bring it back inside, because Dr. No had done that too. Once they got on Crab Key, it was all about being inside, right? And right, I felt like they were like, let's repeat that. I mean, it's in the book too, but I love how the Orient Express would have been the kind of thing that audiences at the time would have just marveled at the idea, you know. In my day and age growing up, it would have been like putting something on the Concorde, you know, or whatever, which is, you know, nobody knows what that is anymore, right? And so, all right, I guess your day and age, it would be on whatever Elon SpaceX rocket or whatever nowadays, but you know, what do we got going on? But, or it's probably on the internet now. What am I talking about? But I mean, really, like, I love the nature of the whole Orient Express thing. And then he's got Tatiana, all this lingerie, you know, and he's back and forth with Karen Bay, and they're having these conversations in and outside of the room, and everybody walking by them, you're suspicious of, half of which you, yes, never see again. But the ones you kind of go like, ah, oh, no, probably nobody, actually is the spy that's trailing them. And you love how, like, they can't go anywhere where there's not five other people watching them. And I love spy movies that cop to the fact that you are never alone. Somebody's always got eyes, right, on you. And I mean, even when he gets to Istanbul, the driver's like, oh yeah, there's been people following us, we follow them, it's a game we play. And that was in Dr. No too, when Jack Lord walks in as Felix Leiter, you know, like they spot, right, each other immediately, and they just kind of cat and mouse around it. I love the part of these kind of movies, and particularly Bond movies, when they don't treat the audience like you're stupid, you know, like, no, these people are all watching each other. Like, there's nobody you can trust. You never know where it's coming from. And it makes it so much fun to watch when the action starts to ramp back up.
Well, I think it's the advantage of the time this came out. Cause, like, as we professed earlier, this isn't, you know, M talking about Crisis, the Cold War, and Casino Royale. This is truly, or Christ, I missed the Cold War. That's the correct quote. This is a genuine Cold War story. And so I think with Bond, we've gotten accustomed to the ubermensch nature of what audiences have come to expect out of the character. Like, if he falls out of a plane or falls off a bridge, we know he's going to catch something and survive or glomp onto that or fight Christopher Walken on top of the Golden Gate Bridge or something like that. Like, that never really happens here. And when the movie decides to go big, towards the middle of Act Two, where you do have the heist and then Karen blows up the consulate and that kind of thing, and they go through the rummage of that, then the movie decides to be self-contained. It's almost like the producers are like, hey, you had this big action scene. Okay, audiences, you had your fun. Let's go back to the intimate stuff. Let's continue to build upon Tatiana as a character. Let's have Red Grant finally meet Bond, and let's see how that trifecta plays out. Let's see what happens when Karim is assassinated and how that plays out. And I think everything on that train is so good. And it's interesting to me, going from this movie about 4 weeks ago, or maybe a month ago at this point, recording with our friend Lindsay Wilkins about Casino Royale, and how that movie, in a lot of ways, they take a 1953 novel, a great book in my opinion, and they retool it to a post 9/11 world, but they only refer to 9/11. I think there's a scene I vividly remember. It's a blinker you miss it moment, where on M's laptop it says 9/12. So presumably that's a reference to that. And of course, Malacca being a bomber, the person who, Malacca being the free runner that Craig battles in the beginning of that film and during the foot chase. A lot of that version of the story feels very reactionary for the new millennium. And I definitely think For Much But Love, just through the threat of having Spectre wanting to really weaken both powers, is in and of itself scary. And I can imagine for a 1963 audience around the world seeing this for the first time, having someone like Robert Shaw, who is so blonde, he's steely, and his eyes are so hazily blue that they're pungent, that they just look like they're staring into you like a dagger. And the fact that there's that shot, I didn't want to skip over this part, but there's that shot where Bond is just it goes from Bond being debriefed in the hotel, him sitting down, and then you see Red Grant walk out of the car that he's using to tail Bond. He's putting the gloves on, fastening those up, or taking the gloves off, excuse me. And then later on, we see that the person that was driving that car has been strangled. It's amazing to me just how in the early 60s, Terrence Young as a filmmaker just had his grip on visual geography and the visual language of where things are going. And I think when you have a movie where it's a thriller, but it's driven by dialogue, you really don't get that much action, to be honest. It's a tight runtime because you're so riveted by the plot. And you have heist movie mechanics at the beginning, kind of delivering that pulpy punch to it. I think that's why this movie tends to, as much as, because again, I love older films in general, but I think when I show people For Much But Love, whenever I tell people, I'm like, okay, if you're going to get into older Bond, this is one of the ones that you need to see. People who aren't accustomed to the language of older movies, they get really into this one. I think it's a lot of those reasons that I mentioned. I mean, that's why, is because it goes from being colorful, it goes from being big, you have the macro, and then it oscillates between the micro in very expert level precision. And I give most of the credit to Terrence Young, because he's just, he kills it in these first couple movies.
Like, the piece of film grammar specifically around the Red Grant character that I love is that you never hear him raise his voice. He's so cold and so quiet and so deliberate. And he talks in that old man, old boy. Mm-hmm. So he's just cool. And, you know, Connery's trying to knock him off his game, and it never gets his blood pressure up, only when they're fighting, like literally. And it's a trope, you know, when he starts laying out like, this is why I'm going to do this or whatever. And it's for two reasons. The audience needs to hear that reiterated so you remember the Siamese fish from the beginning. But it's also exactly the kind of thing that someone like this would say and do, because he is such a sadist, because he just killed his driver because he could. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing this person would do, because they want you to know how much you're going to suffer. You know, everybody that is a sociopath leaves behind some kind of manifesto, right? Video, written, right? And this is no different. And I love that about this. I mean, I hate that Karim has to die, but you know he's going to. You know he's dead meat. He's too good of a friend.
Right.
So, but when Grant kills him and the Russian agent at the same time, like, now Bond is like, is he with Tatiana? Is that where this is going? He doesn't know, you know, until Grant drugs her. And then when they get into that train fight, man, and what's amazing about this is that there's only one shot of it where it's not Shaw and Connery. And it was just because it didn't look right. They had the stunts to it. The rest of it, it's those two guys beating the hell out of each other, working stiff in that little set. And it's incredible. They tried to recreate that years later with Dave Bautista and Daniel Craig. Mm-hmm. That kind of works, but let's be real. If Dave Bautista got his hands on Daniel Craig, he would destroy him, because Dave Bautista is a real fighter. Like, I know he's a wrestler, right. He's a real MMA guy. Like, he could kill people, all right?
No, Daniel, I used to watch him WWE SmackDown back in the day.
Daniel Craig's a tough dude, but he even tell you, like, Dave could murder me with his pinky, you know? But, you know, Robert Shaw and Sean Connery are about the same size, so mm-hmm. they're an even match. It's very cool to watch those two go at each other, and the way that Connery finally gets the drop on him when he turns his watch around on him and uses his own weapon against him. I'm like, that's the only way that guy could have gone down. You couldn't shoot him, kick him, you gotta choke him out. And yes, that it's like beating you with your own move. It's a great twist.
And it's shot so perfectly. Like, it's photographed so perfectly, because literally Grant, he rams Connery's body into one side of the compartment in the train, and then Connery has to kick him. And then literally they have to go from fisticuffs to doing kicks. and the camera closes in on them at the right points, and then it goes back on them when again it's that macro micro moment that I think a lot of even newer action movies, I would say most new action movies, still don't understand in kind of capturing that. And you're right, just looking at the fight in Spectre, I think that's one of the highlights of that film. However, you know, they don't even go as far as to make Craig bleed, because it's shot so wide. It's used with a little bit of modern accentuation to make the fight look more real. This is actually two similarly sized Brits fighting, or similarly sized one Scotsman, the other British, clobbering one another. And the fact that both of them look so different, I think also helps the eye, because there's a very clear good versus evil thing going on. And it's two opposing forces throughout the film that are finally going at. It's one of the best, one of the best fights in the whole series.
And that's the twist on that whole good evil thing, usually, because it's usually the white hat's the good one, the black hat's the bad one. But in this case, Connery's the dark and the tanned one, and Grant's the bright one with the blonde hair, and he's striking, right? So it's sort of there's a little twist there. And I think what Young is saying to us in that is like, y'all, the difference in all these things is a lot closer than you really think. I think in modern audiences, we all realize like the differences in the different things are, there's really not that much. Like, you just switch it just a little bit left and right. We're all about the same kind of messed up, like when we come to those like drawn lines. But in this case, like that's a juxtaposition to what you think you should see, right? But and it only works on a subconscious level. When you think about it and you watch it again, you call it out, you're like, holy cow, this is the thing. And what's amazing about this is it's not even the climax of the movie. It's the beginning of the third act. And that's a bold choice, because we're going to take out the big threat, or what we thought was the big threat, right now. But we'll learn later the bigger threat, of course, was Kleb. We'll get to her. But what I love is that at the end of this, because Grant did lay it all out for him, Bond's like, well, we're going to take his plans to escape and just follow them ourselves. What a great idea.
Now, that is classic Bond. Like, that is... And I don't mean classic, because this is classic. This movie is a classic, but that is Bond not being a superhero, but him finally getting the upper hand. And I think that's the proper, it's very properly timed, because that's when, like you said, Jay, that's when the last 30 minutes comes. That's when we get the boat chase stuff. That's when we get, you know, Bond shooting a series of bombs that go off that ends up blowing up a bunch of guys from Spectre. Like that's where you get more of those Hitchcockian thrills. And I think that's really cool, because like Hitchcock said with his bomb theory, the audience knows the bomb's about to go off, but the characters don't, which is where the suspense comes from. And now that Bond knows what the suspense is, that's where you can start getting the bomb going off. And I think, and I like how this movie is a literal pressure cooker. Because after all that stuff, that's when you get into the real, what in a modern movie would be the final boss fight. And this one, I like how, going back to the whole intimate closed area thing, I like how Bond is, you know, he's just freshening up. Tatiana's just sitting over there. Kleb comes in disguised as a hotel clerk and literally tells Tatiana with her mouth, with a finger over her mouth, like, hey, shh, you know? And it's just such a beautiful moment when Connery is finally like, Kleb, and then she has to go after him with the go after him with the knife shoe. And I think that's such a wonderful, the way that all plays out is wonderful.
Well, it's great how much down this film comes, like, I mean, down to earth and down into smaller places again, after going to that big speedboat chase and all that explosion and everything. And before Kleb gets dispatched to him, we see Blofeld going, well, my two henchmen, you've both screwed up royally. I'm going to kill you now. And you think it's going to be her, and it's the chess playing dude, because he screwed up the train hit, right? You realize, like, no, that was him, and he fouled it up. So, and that's the warning to her, like, don't come back without his head on a platter, or else. It's just, she knows, like, okay, fine, I'm going to do the suicide mission. So she gets the poison shoe. What kills me about it is that she pulls a gun on him after she's got the lecture machine. And I'm like, all she's got to do is kick him in the shin and it's over. He's poisoned and he's done.
Right.
And this is how you know the one rule that Bond taught us. evil is stupid, and that's how good will always triumph, because evil will never use what is most environmentally safe in front of them. Like, no, I'm going to back up and shoot you with this stupid gun and take a chance that my Red Sparrow is going to stay in my clutches when I don't realize she's had the Connery James Bond magic penis now, so she has been corrupted ultimately. There's no way I can escape, but it's a great fight. And these are only things you know if you know the Bond verse, but just watching the movie for what it is, it's once again where Bond has to be, what do I have around me? He's got a chair and he pins this little woman to the wall where she can't right. get at him. And it's like holding the little person away from you, you know, so they can't swing at you. And I love that it's Tatiana that picks up the gun and delivers the final shot. Like, she makes the choice there. Like, no, I'm done being in your clutches or really anybody else's. And she's like, I'm defecting, goodbye, and she blows her away. I mean, it's there's no blood. It's kind of a corny looking death scene, but it's also very cool. Like, I love the death scene that Cleb gets where she's sliding down the wall, because it's she didn't need to go out easy. She had to go out hard, and it's a great way to go out.
Well, aren't Bond movies in terms of characterization kind of interesting experiments, Jay? Because like Bond himself, at least for the first 40 years of the character, before you finally get to Craig in 2006, he's not a deep character. Like, there are certain movies where they kind of toy with that aspect of him, but you need to have, in the best ones, in my opinion, you need to have a Bond girl, or at least characters around him, one or two, who experience some kind of arc. And I think it's interesting that Bond is the character who is in over his head. Like, he's confident. His confidence is what gets him through the first 75% of the movie. Not cruise control like the later movies, but he still is successful and formidable in his own right. But then you have Tatiana, who, after the murder of Karim in the train, along with the Russian agent, she starts to experience some maturity as well. And so I think her making that choice to kill Cleb after she is like visibly taking the gun and aiming it in different directions, partially because she doesn't know where to shoot, but also she doesn't know if she even wants to even shoot or if she's who she's going to shoot at, because this is the end of her mission. This is the end of her road, basically. And so I think it all kind of comes together, because going back to what you also said, Jay, about the whole about Cleb kind of being a maternal figure in a lot of ways to Tatiana, and also presumably other women who are affiliates of Spectre or the Soviet Union consulate. I feel like you kind of, the way Tatiana looks in, she's always looked schoolgirly to me, especially when she's introduced. Like, you see her talking to other, like a couple of other women, presumably of similar ages. And then I've always seen her first scene with Cleb as kind of her going into the tunnel, her going to the darkness of that. And us not really knowing how she'll come out of it. And so I think that's cool. That this movie really kind of plays with who she is from Bond's vantage point. Like, okay, there's this really attractive woman on a picture. Okay, we're going to write the title of the movie on her. All right, cool. We don't see her again until we literally see her legs. So she's objectified from the get-go because she's talked to Cleb, because she has had that little touch of villainy to her. And that's when we don't know who this Tatiana is. And I think that it's really rad that that this movie really plays with that. And I mean, I love the ending where after that, where they're they're, you know, they're on the boat, they're going through all the tourist stuff, and Bond finally throws the film, like that little piece of what was going to scandalize the entire British government. I love how, again, micro macro, I love how it comes back to this little small piece of film that they don't know what to do yet. But because Bond is basically like, come here, you know, like
I'm with you. I love this. It's why I've always said that The Rock is a secret James Bond movie, and that the crack theory years later that Bond is just a moniker for all these people. Sorry, Skyfall, it is. And they just keep relaying it on the next 007. I love that one wound up in jail somehow and got out of Alcatraz, and then ended up giving Nicolas Cage that film that he stuck half of in, you know, some church leg or whatever. That's how I've always retconned it as. But I love that, because that's a total callback to this, because what you realize is that no matter what he's doing, Bond's going to have a good time with this girl. Yeah, whatever. but his mind is always on the mission. He knows, like, got to make sure that never winds up on anybody's hands. So let's just throw it in Venice, and that's the end of that. And I'm like, it's a great moment. Which what would have been kind of neat is if there had been a couple of boats coming behind him with people kind of looking, you know, with like a net or something, you know, just imagine that could happen. But maybe, you know, that's too much overlay. Like, we got to let him get away with it.
That's Roger Moore type.
Yeah, that's probably that. Maybe even, like a Mr. Kent kind of thing going on in some of the later ones. But no, I like the way this ends. I like the way it ties up and gives us a great send off, got great music, and it just sort of soars us into the end of the credits. And such a fun time. Well, Preston, I think we're at the part of the podcast where it's time to give final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. So for those that aren't knowing, for our guests' sake, we rate everything here on the size of the popcorn. The bigger the popcorn, the better. And you can add whatever modifier you want to your heart's content. What are your final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings for From Russia With Love?
Oh, wow. Well, first off, my first recommendation is this movie. If people are listening to this, if you're interested in Bond, if you just happen to type in From Russia With Love in your Spotify feed and this podcast came up, which it should, because everyone should be subscribed to Filmstrip, great podcast. I love this movie. I think it is so endemic and also very representative to what the best of Bond is. It's a movie that I really did try to, besides the hiccups from some of the villains that are just built into the genre, where they have to monologue and then that's how Bond goes around them and succeeds. There's really no real problems with this movie. And that's rare to find in a Bond film. Like, there are so many Bond films where even the best ones can be either a little convoluted, a little overlong, a little too sexist to modern taste. And this movie finds a very smart way to curtail all of that. And it does so 60 years after it came out, which I think is amazing. I think it's arguably, along with Goldfinger, Connery's best performance in the role. I think he is so dashing, even more dashing here than he was in Dr. No. I think it builds upon what works about Dr. No and really improves upon it. The Lois Maxwell's Moneypenny scenes are great. Bernard Lee kills it. Always love seeing him as M and also in his other classics as well. And iconic Robert Shaw performance, great music from John Barry. I believe this was his first time actually taking over as main composer for the series. His last is, he skipped, Spy Who Loved Me. And then his last one was, Living Daylights. And so, I think overall he did 10 of the films and he really did put his touch musically on creating not just what the series sound was, but the spy movie sound that's so ripped off, as well as the tropes of this film. So I think it's a tight thriller, amazing action, what action there is. And it's just a really, really true, honest to God classic. And, I give it 9 out of 10, popcorn, where I can't quite give it a 10, just based on a few things that I mentioned. And also just due to the nature of this franchise, I think aiming for that level of 10 out of 10 perfection that even some modern superhero movies kind of flirt closer to. Like I can't go as far as a 9, even though it's probably a 10 in my heart. But recommendations adjacent to this, I do recommend Hunt for Red October. Again, that's a staple, but I feel like that's a spy movie that's starting to fall out of people's esteem a little bit. I hear more people talk about the more bombastic action movies from the 90s. And I think Red October is definitely one of the best. It is a great kind of spiritual successor to a movie like this. I also think a great recommendation something like Spy Game, the Tony Scott movie, where Redford is kind of passing the torch to Brad Pitt. I think, and that's also a heist movie. So again, some From Russia With Love energy there. There's others that unfortunately I should have wrote more of my recommendations down, but those are the two that come to mind. But that's all I have to say as far as my final thoughts go about From Russia With Love.
Yeah, I'm going to echo a lot of what you said. I think what makes this movie work and work so well is that it is pretty simple and self-contained, but it's also very deep. And you've got characters that are so much fun to watch. And because it's not hung up on the gadgets or the big technology or the, you know, the big nuclear thing. It's really, we're trying to avoid a scandal. Like there's no, and it marries things that I like, a heist movie and a political thriller. You dropped 3 Days of the Condor, you know, earlier. And I mean, I think like that or Day of the Jackal, you know, something like those things like that, that I love, like a good political intrigue with a little bit of action too. And I think this movie is one of the best marriages of that in the Bond verse forever. And it's my favorite Connery performance. It's not my favorite of the Connery movies. That's actually Thunderball. So maybe we'll have that conversation one day. But I love this movie because I think it does give him the chance to be incredibly dashing, to be smart, and to use other people along the way, and to never get too far behind or too far ahead of the audience and the plot. And it's so much fun. And Terrence Young maps this thing out very much like a Hitchcock movie, like a North by Northwest or something like that. And you can tell that there's seeds of that all through it. And it makes it so much fun. And it's just a blast to go back and revisit. Even 60 years old, this movie holds up in so many ways. And that's a wild thing to say. And I'm with you, man. Like, you know, it in popcorn parlance, I think we're both in the same place. This is a large popcorn with extra butter all the way. And it's just a good time. And it should be a lot of fun. So I'm a big fan of this one, and I recommend to people to check it out. And I think you dropped some other great recommendations in there too for people. And that's the kind of stuff you can get if you follow Preston in all the great places where you can keep up with what he's got going on. Preston, tell people how they can follow you on the internet.
Sure. You can find me on twitter.com at PRESTOMIT or letterboxd.com at PRESTON_MITCH. At the latter, I'm always plugging away at very exhaustive, very epic length reviews of things, some of which you can actually find linked to on my Twitter feed, where I'm always kind of come up with threads about what I'm watching that day or that evening, or just kind of what's on my mind in the movie space. Please come find me. I love talking to other movie fans and connecting with them, and especially meeting people like Jay. And thank you again, man, seriously, for having me on your show. It's a great privilege.
Oh, hey, listen, the privilege was all ours, and I really appreciate you accepting the invitation and coming on. And we'll link all the press and stuff in the podcast description below. So definitely follow him. Strong recommend. And check out the other shows he's on and has been on too. Those are incredible episodes. All of those are friends of this podcast, some of which have been on this podcast or will be on it in the future. And I definitely want you to check those out as well. Preston, again, thanks so much for coming and being a part of Filmstrip. Folks, you can follow this show's social media at Filmstrip Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Mastodon. I don't know where else Ron's got us, but there you're going to find announcements about upcoming shows. You'll see Ron interact a lot on the Filmstrip feed. Sometimes I'll throw some stuff out there too. You can find a link to our podcast for Spotify now. That's what Anchor's become. That's our distribution site. If you go to filmstrippodcast.com, that'll take you everywhere you can find this show. Wherever you can find podcasts, again, Apple, Spotify, Google, all those places, please share the show. And if you like it, leave us a positive review. It helps other people find it. We've been doing this a long time, and we're just going to keep doing it because it's fun talking about movies with good folks like Preston and interacting with folks like you. So for Preston, I'm Jay. Thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.